we'll open up the House Committee on Human Services, Friday, February 19th, 2010. And we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 991A. Rick.
Briefly, Chair, this does define respite services and exempt providers of certain parental respite services from regulation by Department of Human Services. Statute that these respite service providers are mandatory child abuse reporters, and that these are the staff and not the volunteers, and does require these providers to be enrolled in the central background registry for the child care division. We also have dash A7 amendments in front of you. These are a technical fix that the child care division wanted to ensure that providers are applied to and are enrolled in this central registry. The there's a minimal fiscal and no revenue on the A7s as well as the original bill. And I'll defer background to our presenters.
Great. Thank you very much.
I got that yesterday. Okay.
President Peter Courtney and Sasha. Good morning, Senator. We're happy to see you on this side of the building today.
Chair Tomei and Vice Chair Olson and members of the House Committee on Human Services. My name is Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Island View Drive North in Salem. Zip code's 97303. I represent Senate District 11. That's parts of Salem, huge parts of Salem, and it goes all the way up through Jervis and Woodburn. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 991A, which is before you. It came off the Senate floor. I believe it was a 30-0 vote. And what this bill is about is today, probably at all times, there are families that are struggling. Particularly today, they could lose a job, they could lose their home. Illness is always out there. Life has its crosses. We all know that. And there does exist in our society help for the family, particularly for the children, in the form of relief nurseries. And I assume that all of you pretty much are familiar with relief nurseries. You may even have one in your community. I believe in my community I have two. And I know that I think they originated in the great community in the great area of Eugene, Springfield. I believe that was the first relief nursery. We also have foster care, and we all know about foster care, Department of Human Resources, which is a difficult situation for a family and for a child. But there was developed in Chicago, we discovered through my staff, particularly Sasha Pollack, who joins me today, in the great city of Chicago, and I say that with a smile. It is a great city, but there's been something happened recently about Chicago. And a program that, in effect, would say to a struggling family, we will help you with your children while you're struggling. You don't have to give up your children. We will take your children for a day or two or three or up to 44 days. That's the average, maybe even a year. And it would involve people like myself and my wife, to be frank with you. We have three sons, but all our sons now have gone. So we have room in our house, and we would volunteer. They would all be volunteers. There's no pay involved. And what in effect is, you take the children into your home while they're working their way through this crisis. The family visits them. You want to visit them. You want them to visit them. There's no taking the children away. And it's done by nonprofits, in the community. And the faith-based is basically where it started. It doesn't have to be faith-based, but that's where it started. And today, I believe, they're serving somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 children. They have 700 family volunteers, and a waiting list of volunteers to take in children in these circumstances. The average age of the child that's taken in is just under 5 years of age, before, in effect, if I may say so, the real damage has been done to a child often, so that you don't get in, and I'm not going to knock foster care, it's easy to knock foster care, but foster care does involve you take the children away from the parents. Sometimes you don't allow the parents to be involved with the child. That's not what it's about. And the bill was made necessary because we had to work with the Department of Human Resources, which we did. They're here to support it, children and families. They're here. We didn't do anything without their approval. We had to work with the nonprofits. They're here, the religious communities. And we are going to pilot program that here, Catholic Community Services, in Salem and McMinnville in particular, and with the $50,000 amount of money being raised by the private sector, which has already been raised, to go. The bill basically allows us to work within existing state law involving the welfare of children to allow this program to get underway. Now, the volunteers still have to do a background check. I can't simply say I'm a good human being, my wife and I are good human beings. Trust us. We still would have to go through a background check. They do it in Chicago. There has to be some kind of background check. But it's apparently back in Chicago, their human resources people had their doubts. Tennessee, where this has been adopted in some other states on a local level, I think this is the first time we'll attempt through a statewide attempt at this. State of Oregon will be the first if you decide you want to do this with your collective wisdom. There were doubts. Tennessee, the human resources director, had his doubts. And we have, that's all we wrote. After watching it, they turned around and became totally supportive of it as a wonderful way to deal with those crisis situations that the released nurses or the foster care in between there. So I speak very globally about this. I understand I wasn't supposed to give you my written testimony. The House does not want anything in writing. You don't give the House anything in writing. So otherwise, it breaks my heart because I always leave behind me written testimony. I don't just come and talk. I like to read my, I don't like to read it, as you can tell, but I want to leave you with a document until Sasha says you do not bring them anything because they're very advanced people. And they don't do that. So I've got a few copies in case you're not, but like the good Vice Chair Olson is ignoring me because he's reading, he's doing all this right on his computer. He's showing all he is advanced technologically. I don't even have one of those things. I don't know how to use them. I'm not going to get into that with him, but I'm happy for him that he is much, well, he's a little bit, not my age, much younger, but he's still very advanced. So Vice Chair told me, I am so pleased you're willing to even hear this bill. We worked very hard. For months and months, we've been working on this. Months. This is an eight-month effort. And we had a remarkable press conference because the individual, Dr. Anderson, who started this, flew out here, more than one flew out here, and before the press did a remarkable job and for the committee talking about it. I even learned more and more every time I hear him talk. And he was grilled pretty hard. And he's a delightful human being, more than willing to come back to describe how this program started and what it's doing in Chicago and that area for children that get themselves and families in this situation, as well as other parts of the country. So with that, I will stop. Chair Toomey, again, thank you very much for being gracious enough to even hear Senate Bill 991.
Thank you, Senator. Really appreciate coming. It sounds like a wonderful program. Sasha, do you have anything to add to that?
Chair Toomey, for the record, Sasha Pollack. I work in Senator Courtney's office. I just was here to answer questions about specifics about the program. I can certainly go into any other details. I can also talk about the amendment, and it's a very minor amendment, and why that's in front of you today. We also have Josh Graves from Catholic Community Services, who is here in the audience, if you would like to talk to him about the program they're planning on implementing here in Salem and McMinnville, as Senator Courtney said. But I know you guys have a lot on your schedule, so I'm happy to answer questions instead.
Great. And I think actually, Senator, we do have some written material from your office. Oh, at least from Human Services, right?
Well, this testimony, yeah.
Yeah, we have material from Human Services and also Mickey Cerise, also from Human Services. Mm-hmm. So we should have two things. They really can read. I know the rumor has gone to the other side of the building that they don't read very well, but they actually they do. And okay, so let's open it up to questions. To me, this is a fantastic program, and it sort of follows up on our program on Wednesday about relief nurseries. It seems to me this is sort of a logical extension of that kind of relief process for families who are having problems. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sasha, how does the referral part of it work? Who organizes that, and how did the child actually get in this volunteer home?
Chair Tomei, Representative, there's a variety of ways in which it works. In Chicago, about 85% of the referrals come from the Department of Human Services there. They're folks who maybe haven't risen to the level of need to be requiring foster care, removal of the child from the home, but have self-identified or have been identified as having a need of the crisis situation, potentially a short-term or maybe a long-term issue, and they're identified as a good candidate for this. Other times, folks hear about it in the community and come forward and say this is something that I would, you know, we're feeling like we need in terms of caring for our children. And the the organization acts kind of as a placement agent and says, these are the folks we're, you know, they send out on, in Chicago, they have a Twitter account that they're using. They're using a lot of technology to say, we have an 8-year-old child who needs to, you know, a short-term home. Maybe they talk about the reason, maybe they don't, and who can respond to this. And they get quick feedback from their volunteers, and they place that child often with, usually within the day, often as soon as 45 minutes after they found out from the parent that there's a need. So did that
follow up? So I don't, from the quick placement that you're talking about, I guess I don't maybe necessarily see judges getting involved using this as an option maybe before choosing foster care.
Chair Tomei, Representative Huffman, this is a slightly different population than the foster care population. If you're getting into a position where a judge is involved, that's I think it's further along that trajectory towards foster care, and they wouldn't be kind of the appropriate family for this kind of program.
Chair Tomei, Representative Huffman, that's a very interesting statement he's made, because I'm glad you did it. We are all trained to think about these things a certain way. There is a mindset. I had the hardest time for months understanding what was going on here, if you understand, because I am relief nursery foster care. That's all I know, if you understand what I'm saying. Or juvenile delinquency detention centers, if you understand what I'm saying. I mean, that's how I think. And I couldn't understand where this came in. You understand, I had to change my frame of reference dramatically, because I thought of courts, social workers, that's just, you know, relief nurses, that whole thing. You have to get out of that mindset. I'm not telling you you have to. I'm just telling you, your question is very good, because I still struggle to this day, but I'm getting better. No, I'm getting better. The press conference got me a lot better. You see, I'm a slow learner, Representative Fletcher, because I know you're looking at me thinking, Peter, like I'm slow. I'm a slow learner. Just listening to Dr. Anderson and giving coming up with an example, I started to understand it more and more. The judges are not involved with this. That's the thing of this. I'm a Catholic. Don't think we took Catholic Community Services because I'm a Catholic. I didn't even know who we were going to take. This is not proselytization. So just, if that's what you're thinking, you're wrong. I don't care, you know, non-profit. I'm not here to proselytize. It happens to be Catholic Community Services, my community. It's willing to take the lead in this thing. You can go into that services. We get the word of mouth out, you know, volunteers going in. And the dynamic is that judges are not involved, because if you get into that, we're not there. We've made a mistake. We want to get long before that, because that's when you start to build a barrier between the child and their parents. The child becomes defensive. You're taking my child away from me. You know, you get into all that. That's, we want short of that. We don't want that involved here. We want that parent to think, I'm in trouble. I'm struggling, but I don't want to talk about it because I'll lose my kids. Or, you know, they got enough things going on. But you want the child taken care of, too. You understand what I'm saying? You want this family held together in this crisis time. So I'm raising my voice, but please, I hope you don't think I'm raising my voice. You do understand, because I don't know you that well. So you're not getting all mad at me, are you?
You're fine,
Sam. Okay, I'm fine, because I can't, I just don't know anything.
For now.
So the thing is, it's that kind of dynamic, and it's been hard for me to figure it out. Finally, I think I'm okay. I got it. I know how it works, and it's going to happen. But we are just starting, so we're going to work our way through this. I have to tell you a cute story, at least, and I can't identify the person. As I'm giving the speech to Senator Flora, a certain state senator, she doesn't have any children, turns to her husband who works with her and says, get our house ready, buddy, clean it up, because I want to do this. And I thought it was a very fascinating thing. That's the exact type of situation in terms of the volunteers. Now, you're asking about the family, but that's the exact kind of thing that we hope to get that kind of reaction. And there's a major business player in this community who's chair of the Children and Family Commission for the state of Oregon, big-time player. And he and I at the press conference, he pledged he'd had the $50,000. He had it by 5 o'clock that night. I knew he would, because I said it on national TV he would, and that sort of set him up. But that's the kind of dynamic we got good. We got the business community, we got nonprofits, we got the faith community, and we got human resources. So again, I'm nervous that you're not understanding what's happening here, but if you're not, it's okay. Well, it's not so okay that you don't vote the bill out. But it's okay if you need to struggle with the concept for a while.
Madam Chair.
I've got for you.
Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair, because I'm going to have to step out for a minute, but I had to thank you so much for doing this. I think what we're seeing here is our prevention paradigm set in place, and this is maybe just a hair after the usual stuff, but takes the pressure off a little bit, and as the senator said, before that we need the system and that whole, what it takes, entails. And I'm just so happy that you're doing this. This is a great idea. You've got my support for sure. And I also think if you could raise $50,000 for our ocean energy project we're doing that fast, we need to talk. But now, Senator Courtney, this is exactly where we need to be going, because you're right in saying we think in this way that we kind of wait till there's a problem and then we deal with it. Whereas, you know, you can start with a totally new family on primary prevention and help with parent ed, et cetera, et cetera. But if there's just a little bit of a crisis you need to address and it just doesn't rise to that, there's this place, this space in there that there's nothing there for people. Am I making myself clear,
yes,
too?
Yes.
So I think, and that's kind of, it's hard to describe. You're right. It's even harder to describe than proving prevention works. But thank you so much. This is great. And Chicago. Out of Chicago. That's good.
We have Representative Van Orman, then Representative Olson, and Representative.
I'll defer to Representative Olson.
Go ahead. Well, for just I have two questions, but I just want to make a point before the Vice Chair leaves that it appears that he gets it.
Yes. Okay.
Wow.
Okay. Here's what?
It appears that she gets it.
Oh, I think
wow.
so.
Okay.
Well, I have a congressman, so but
right
I'm going to wait. Yes, I'll wait. If we're going to vote,
okay.
We're going to vote, but I've got some questions before we vote.
Anyways, okay. Senator Courtney, I was just kind of curious when you mentioned Tennessee. Do you have a contact or Sasha a contact that we could get in touch with back there in Tennessee for this whole program?
Chair Tomei, Representative, I can get you one.
Okay, and follow up. I would be curious, how long have they been doing this?
In Tennessee? I do not know the answer to that. I can find out, though. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Representative Van Orman?
I'll try to be brief. Thank you, Chair Tomei. In the new enrollment of children in the health plan, there were volunteers in my district who really wanted to sign up these kids. But the bureaucratic red tape is so onerous that a number of them dropped out. So the way I'm seeing this is probably what we need for the Oregon Health Plan. It's beyond the bureaucracy. It doesn't get engaged in red tape. It simply allows children to be placed in a safe place.
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, that's correct. We have people here from Human Resources and Children and Family Services of Human Resources that can describe why that is, because that's very, very important. That's why we needed a bill to do exactly what you said.
Okay.
And I'm, again, not. It's easy. I'm not beating up Human Resources Department at all by any stretch of the imagination. Sadly, we have to have it, but I'm sure
that's
you
right.
work.
That's, right.
That's exactly right.
Let's see. Representative Maurer and then Representative Doherty.
Madam Chair, and the question is, then what's the nexus between the state and this organization? Why do we need a law? Because a nonprofit, I mean, I could take someone's kid if they said, yeah, you can have my kid.
Well, because, Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, again, I want the question more. I'm going to start the answer, but I hope we can hear from the officials that are here to explain it, because there is the background check. Mm-hmm. You understand? It is true. I could simply go to a volunteer organization. I'm a member of the YMCA. I'm a member of St. Joe's Catholic Church. I could simply go in there and say, if you got a kid, just give them to me. And that sounds good, but I know, you know what I mean. But we still have an obligation to make sure that the volunteers that are coming forward are truly people that we would trust with children. So we do have that little thing going on in life here. It's true of wherever this is. So there is that alone brings in, so you say, some kind of organization or structure or state law in terms of saying you have to go through a background check to have you checked out. So that alone, if you understand what I'm saying, Representative Maurer, is one of the reasons. You cannot be a volunteer. You will not be a volunteer unless you subject yourself to this background check. Now, how extensive we can get into that, it's not like a body search or anything, but we are going to ask the volunteers to be willing to do that. And apparently, it's working in other places. They don't mind that. They're still coming forward, and they're still willing to subject themselves, if that's the word to use, you know, to that kind of background check, because they want to be a volunteer in this program. Does that answer your question a little bit more? If it's not, we will bring forward your reasons, and they can lay out exactly all the technical reasons why this bill is needed.
And we'll bring up DHS to answer that, too. Representative Doherty.
In the Chicago model that you're using, is there a training component for the parents that want to assist with these children?
Chair Tomei, Representative Doherty, yes, there is a home visit similar to what we see in foster care. There is training of the volunteer family, and then there's ongoing site visits to the home as the children, as the child or children have been placed there. In a lot of ways, it's the staff interaction, other than the legal component, is very similar to what we'll see in a foster care situation.
And Chair Tomei, it's an interesting question. Just the other day, I learned that the head of Ardner Relief Nurseries came into my office. I know her very well. She's been very successful. And she said to my wife, Sue Miller's her name, said, you know, really, we really are excited about this program, and we would like to be the ones that train the parents. You know what I mean? Right here. They want to be, since you said that, and I didn't know that, but they just 2 days ago, Sue walked in my office and said, we would like to be the one, we're talking to Catholic Community, said, we'd like to be the ones that helps train the parents.
Thank you very much.
And she was our main presenter just Wednesday.
Okay, so you know about her.
Oh, yeah. She's great. Representative Dimbro.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Looking at the experience in the states or the areas that have done this, has anything risen where, you know, problems arose that we can learn from, Sasha, in looking at those that, when they were sharing their experience? Did perhaps they were going in one direction and then, you know, a problem arose and they learned from that we can learn from? And then let me also ask if there's been discussion of if... you know, if something were to go wrong in the home, the kid had an accident and, you know, needed medical care or, you know, something went wrong, is there a requirement that the family have insurance, you know, property or liability insurance just to, you know, to anticipate that problem?
Chair Tomei, Sasha, Representative Denver, these are questions that have not been asked. I'm trying to think of when Dr. Anderson spoke. Things they've learned, nothing that threatened the health or safety of the child, some of the things they've learned. So I don't know, I just don't know how to respond to those questions.
Chair Tomei, Representative Dimbro, yes, I believe requirement for insurance is part of the short list of things that is required of a volunteer family. That's like house insurance. There's also Good Samaritan laws, federal Good Samaritan laws that kind of oversee. An additional piece of the program in Chicago, and I'll get back to the first piece of your question in a second, is that a community kind of forms around this. Dr. Anderson described it more as a movement and less as a program. A community, because in their case they're based on faith-based communities, folks from the church who have services to give, dentists, doctors, you know, psychiatrists, other folks like that, are giving their services to these kids in need when it arises in this situation. So these children are not only being exposed to an alternate, you know, family environment, and their parents are being supported in this way, but they're also getting access to other things that they may not have otherwise been able to access for no cost.
Chair Tomei, one thing I just want to say, this is not part of your question, but it does. One of the things they found is a remarkable amount of contact that is maintained after the children go back, you know, the crisis is over and they go back to their family. How much the family that took the children and the family that were struggling, how they still remain in remarkable contact. They have seen that, and I think that caught them a bit by surprise afterwards, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So that surprised them a bit too, if I may say. So that's not, you talk about a problem, but that's sort of, woo. You know, the moment of taking care of the child is over and they went back. The families don't just stop seeing each other. They still continue to see and take an interest in the children as a joint family. So that I think surprised them a bit too, which I think is a positive thing personally.
And Chair Tomei, Representative Dimbro, back to the beginning of your question. I'm not aware of any serious problems in terms of, and I'm sure they've had bugs that they've had to work out of their system. They have been given a grant to help other localities with the technical aspects of setting up this type of program. So they are being very generous in their time in helping Catholic Community Services and folks here in Oregon. And if there are other organizations here in Oregon, we've already had several folks reach out to our office and ask how they can get involved and how they can potentially start this in their communities. And I've had senators who were excited about this kind of nudging their local folks to try to get this started in their communities as well. So we do have that resource to draw on, which will help us to avoid any of those pitfalls that they may have identified that we're unaware of at this point.
So I'm going to have to, speaking of excuse me, I got to go meet with Peter Buckley over the budget, but let me just leave with this. This is not a good example of this, but it just shows you how there's, I have, I'm fortunate, but it does relate. In 1996, we had a tremendous amount of rain in the state of Oregon. I don't think any of you have been to my house, but I live in the Willamette River. So I remember I was down giving a speech in front of the Rotary Club in Corvallis that day. All of a sudden, and literally in the middle of my speech I was speaking, a note has passed to me. It's never happened before in all my speech. It said, Peter, your neighborhood is being evacuated. You must come home immediately. I literally stopped in the middle of my speech. I read the notes. I said, I'm very, very sorry. I'm sorry. I have to go. And I got my car, and I raced up 99W, came here, and to right over here. And as I came, my neighborhood was completely blocked by police car flashing light. And they said, you can't go. I said, and they said, oh, they recognized. All right, Peter, we're going to let you in. I went in. So my wife was just going crazy. And so we, our children then, our three boys, were very young in 1996 as opposed to today. So what are we going to do? So, but Margie immediately called one of her sisters. Margie comes from the Silverton, Mount Angel area. And she came from, there's six siblings, all six boys and children. She called one of them and said, can you come and get Peter, Sean, and Ann? Just come. We got to get the children out of here because we don't know what to do. The waters are coming up. So somehow, I mean, I don't remember whether we took them. I think they came. So we just said, take them. Sleeping bags, go. Take them. We don't know how long it's going to be. Take the children. So immediately then, we couldn't get any more rentals because we had to get the furniture out of the house, and the government got involved. The next thing I know, we took all the furniture, and we just took the vans out. Marge and I stayed in the house with two sleeping bags and our miniature dachshund unit. And we slept on the floor for several days watching this river as it moved up and up and up because, you know, sandbags weren't going to do any good. If you saw where I live, we're going to lose everything. And the thing was coming. I mean, it was coming. And I remember it was 10:15 at night. I went out. It was very dark. And I remember it was coming up. And I remember, I think I literally saw where it crested, which was 1 foot from the top of my bank. My point to you is that was a crisis in our life where I had the resources, I had the extended family to take my children in a way until I dealt with a crisis. Now, sure, I didn't lose my job, I use that as an example, and I wasn't struggling with a health issue, if you understand what I mean, you understand what I'm saying, but I had to do something. We had to do something with Peter, Sean, and Adam. We had to do something with them. You take care of your children, take care of the kids, get them out, we'll stay with the house as long as we can before we leave. This program, in a way, is that kind of program. That's how we want it to be seen, if you can visualize. Now, I realize it's not a very good example because you might say, well, your burden wasn't great enough, Peter. You hadn't lost your job, or you hadn't lost your home, you hadn't just found you had a serious health problem, blah, blah. But in a way, we had very little time. We had to deal with our children. We were fortunate enough to have Aunt Janet and Uncle Ralph, that's who it turned out to be, who took them on. In fact, even they may have given one of the children over then to Aunt Maria and Uncle Dave, who just lived two blocks away, because they're three sons. In fact, when I got through, I think Adam was one place, Sean was another place, and Peter was another place, right there in the Mount Angel Hill. But they were willing to keep them for whatever time. That is this program, if you understand. Except we didn't do a background check on my brother. Did we? We didn't do that. Because we knew him, you know what I mean? But suppose you don't know him. Suppose you don't have that kind of quick extended family. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? So relief nurseries doesn't take them overnight. Foster care is that whole thing. You understand what I'm saying? Foster care, we don't want to get that. So I've had enough to say. You've listened to my whatever I'm doing, harangue long enough. You're just so great to hear the bill. I hope you like it, and I hope that you feel you're comfortable now. There is a committee that you can report it out. So I'm at the mercy of the wisdom of the chair, the vice chairs, and the collective wisdom of this committee. May I be excused?
Absolutely, thank you, Senator. Thank you so much for coming and bringing this great bill to us.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I wanted to just kind of piggyback on Senator Courtney's story there and kind of explain that's one of the reasons behind the bill is if you have extended family that you can leave your children with, you can currently do that, and this is not going to change that at all. This is a bill for folks who don't have that extended family, and so they have, there's two pieces of it. There's the background check piece for the safety of the children, that's the one piece, and there's the other piece, which is the removal of the kind of oversight of DHS from these families and the Catholic Community Services type organization, which we've all heard the horror stories of the woman who takes care of her neighbor's kids for 45 minutes before the bus comes and the state dings her for $75,000 for running an illegal child care organization. We didn't want any of the volunteers who step up to the plate to take these children in to have to deal with something like that. So we had slight modifications to the laws because of that.
And is it appropriate to bring somebody from DHS here? Mickey, would it be you or somebody else in case anybody has any questions about how it would work through DHS? Did I see a hand over here? Ron?
Yeah, Madam Chair, it's really a follow-up to that, it because there's clearly the need, and that's not the issue. The issue is, why does it have to be in statute? Why do we have to have a law to allow people to do it? But as I'm reading the bill, it actually exempts them, so because the law may have been gray, and so maybe that this is a clarifying law to permit them so they don't get caught into this gray area. And would that be an accurate
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, that is exactly what this bill is. It is not establishing a program. It is establishing an environment under which a program can thrive. The program is completely outside of the state's control. The only thing that we did as a state that was a requirement of the program was if a program was to be established, the requirement for background checks was the only thing that we put in statute.
One quick follow-up. So the example of the woman that watches a child for 45 minutes prior to getting onto the bus doesn't apply in this situation because that's not, quote, a program. That's just the good neighbor.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, what I was trying to explain with that example was sometimes when a child that is not related is being cared for in a house, and it depends on state law, that house is considered a child caring site, and specific rules apply in terms of where medication can be stored, how many adults need to be in the room at one time, things like that. And we wanted to make sure that this program was as far away from, there was a very bright white line between what DHS does and what child caring, you know, companies that do child care for a living do, and these volunteers.
So the $75,000 fine for the woman that watching for 45 minutes because she's a neighbor, a good neighbor, is totally not relevant to this conversation.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, we wanted to make sure that nothing like that happened to
this set of people. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. So that means that is it CCD or DHS that's going to keep the list of these volunteers?
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, the nonprofit will keep the list of the volunteers.
Okay.
The Catholic Community Services or whatever local nonprofit does it. The background checks are currently going to be done through the Child Care Division and the criminal background check is done through the state police, I believe. That was in the Dash 4 amendment, and it is similar to what happened last session with metropolitan service districts in terms of background checks on folks who are working at the zoo, for example, with children. We modeled it after that program, right. And we have a representative from the Employment Division here to talk about that if you would like that.
Yes, is there anybody else who wants to talk on this issue? We'd like to have a panel up here. Okay, thank you.
And while she's coming up, I can quickly explain the Dash A7s.
Okay.
Because we can talk about those. The Dash 4 amendment, which included this background
but
check
they're all
piece,
engrossed now, so
yes,
we don't know.
Yes, I'm sorry. The reason I'm saying it had a typo in it, it said the subject individual shall apply to the Central Background Registry, but it didn't require them to actually be registered in the Central Background Registry. That was something that we were trying to fix with the Dash A7s. That's all the A7 does.
But it's engrossed in this.
No, in the current bill, it says a subject individual shall apply to the Central Background Registry. The Dash A7 changes that to shall apply to and must be enrolled in.
And we do have the A7. Got it. Okay, I'm a little slow here. Got it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any questions of anybody in this panel? Here, I bring them up and you don't have any questions for them. All right.
Great job.
All right. Anything you want to say? Why don't you introduce yourselves at least so that we know you were here.
Chair Tomei and Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Boone, members of the committee, I'm Mickey Cerise with the Department of Human Services, Deputy Assistant Director. The one thing I would say is my presence up here and not saying anything is that it exemplifies exactly the process we took establishing this bill. The department was asked to come to the table and make sure that as we looked at this concept, we painstakingly made sure it did not touch anything within the department, which would include our foster care system, the respite care system, the child care facilities that we license. And that turned into, as Senator Courtney mentioned, that turned into quite an effort. We had legislative counsel involved, Department of Justice involved, making sure that we didn't have an unintended consequence. I do think we came up with a good product at the end. We do think we have a bright line that separates this population from the foster care system, the Department of Human Services. I do agree with Senator Courtney. I don't think our system is the best system to raise children. So I think as close as we can keep those children to their biological families, I think that's the best we can do. And I do see this program as being one of the tools that we don't have currently, but we do need in our community safety net programs. So we do support the bill.
Thank you, Mickey.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Hines. I'm the Legal and Compliance Manager with the Child Care Division. And as you've heard from the testimony today in answer to questions, the families that volunteer in this program would be subject to the background check the Child Care Division does for licensed child care providers and now the Metro Zoo employees. So individuals would apply to be enrolled in our registry. We would conduct the same background check we do for those individuals and then either approve or disprove them for enrollment in the registry depending on their background.
Thank you very much. Any questions of anyone on this panel?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Totally off the subject. Kathleen, who took Tom's place?
Chair Tomei, Representative Huffman, we're still in the hiring process.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I say that. We have an acting administrator, and that's Kitty Lake, who's sitting in the back of the room.
Thank you.
Are you retired?
Yes, Representative.
Just a quick comment. Sasha, well done. Thank you very much.
I concur.
Okay, I have to ask them. Did Tom retire?
We're not getting into that.
Oh, okay.
We're not getting into
yes.
that.
Yes. Will you okay, bring any, things up and talking code?
Any other questions that are pertinent to the issue here? All right. Thank you all very much, and especially thank you, Sasha. I know how hard you've worked on this. So with that, we will close the informational hearing, or public hearing, on Senate Bill 991A and open up a work session on Senate Bill 991A, Representative.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -7 amendments.
Representative Olson moves to adopt the -7 amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? So adopted, Representative Olson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 991 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 991A as amended to the floor with the new pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? I'm not even going to take the roll. So that motion passes and it will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. What lucky person would like to take this to the floor?
I'll take it.
All right. Representative Van Arnold, Carrie.
Good.
Great. Thank you very much. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 991A. Okay, we'll open up the informational hearing on the Robert Wood Johnson report on county health rankings in Oregon. And we have a couple of people to testify this morning. It's always good to see you, Dr. Cohn. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Debbie. All right, welcome.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the Acting Director of the Public Health Division at the Department of Human Services. Very much appreciate having the time to talk with you this morning. I will let Jenny introduce herself when she speaks. Unfortunately, Kathleen O'Leary had been on your schedule. She had a family emergency and wasn't able to to make it this morning. So we'll be covering for her, hopefully. Before I start talking about the rankings, I just want to thank those of you who were either able to attend our breakfast about this yesterday or send your staff to do that. I apologize in advance if some of what you're going to hear is duplicative, but hopefully we'll have a little more time to dig into some of the other issues as the discussion proceeds. So this whole project of county health rankings is a project. What I'm going to do is give you some context, a little bit of background, and then Jenny is going to speak about her experience at the local health department level to try to address some of the issues that are called out in this report. This is a project of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We did not design this project. It's a national project. We were informed that these data were being published and that a lot of work had gone into them. And as we started to look at them, it occurred to us that despite the flaws in all of this, and there are some flaws, this really is, I think, an important lens for all of us to look at the health of our communities and really get engaged in the conversation about what we need to do to improve the health of our communities. The overall message here is that really health is everybody's business, not just the Human Services Committee, not just the health care committees, but it really touches so many aspects of our community in so many different ways, both in terms of its impact on other aspects of community life and the way that other parts of the community impact health. So that's the conceptual approach that this project has taken. I believe this is the third year, might be the fifth year, that RWJ has done this. I think they've gotten more sophisticated and refined it with each year. And they're going to continue to do this, I think, over the next couple of years. So I expect you will hear more about this as time goes on. You should all have this document, which is a summary. And I'd like to ask you to turn to page 2, which has this, excuse me, this diagram on it. And what you can see in this diagram, I think it kind of summarizes the approach that was taken here. When most people think about health, they think about health outcomes, I think. So mortality, how many people have died and from what causes, and morbidity. So short of death, what other kinds of health problems do people have? But what this report does, I think, is looks upstream from that and looks at the contributors to those health outcomes. And they fall into, they class them into two broad groups here. They call them health factors and then programs and policies. If you look in the sort of middle blue column there, I want to speak a little bit about this column to you. So first, one of the things that I think is striking about this, I said this yesterday morning as well, is the clinical care box there only accounts for about 20% of the health outcomes that folks are interested in. This is based on a great deal of research. In fact, many people feel probably 20% is actually being quite generous to the contribution of the healthcare component to health outcomes. But you know, I think in many ways we have a lot of work to do, certainly around healthcare, access to healthcare, quality healthcare, and dealing with cost issues and so forth. But if that's all that we do, we're really going to miss the boat in terms of what's driving the health of our communities. Next, I want to say a couple of words about the social and economic factors here, education, employment, income, family and social support, and community safety. Well, I'm a public health practitioner. I'm not a law enforcement officer. I'm not an education official. So why are these things in a report that a public health official is talking about? Well, the data are undeniable that these things have an enormous impact on health. What does that mean for the practice of public health? It certainly doesn't mean that I'm the person primarily responsible for the education system or for dealing with economic development, but it does mean that I have a stake in all of those very important things that go on in our community, in our communities. And I would say that, in a way, you could turn this around as well, because health and the quality of health in our communities affects how well kids are ready to learn, for example, in the education world, how effective we are at doing economic development and generating income and so forth. So these things are undeniably linked, that's why I think they're called out in this report as important determinants. And again, that 40% factor, I think, speaks to how powerful those influences are on health. Finally, I want to talk about the physical environment piece here and the health behaviors piece. I think certainly I've talked with this committee quite a bit, and many of you have been terrific champions for many of these issues, tobacco use and so forth. This is an area where public health clearly is very active and takes the lead in many of these activities. And in fact, we have terrific examples of things that we've done to address some of these issues. So, you know, the tobacco use issue, you all know about our tobacco prevention and education program, all the work that's gone into that. The diet and exercise obesity issue, I'm just giving you one example, you know, the menu labeling legislation that was passed last session. You know, these are all efforts to address that. You know, alcohol use, major contributor, unsafe sex, and so forth. This is not a complete list, obviously, but these are kind of the big ticket items that the research literature suggests around health behaviors that really are very, very important contributors to health. And finally, let me just speak a little bit to the physical environment. These are places where, again, a lot of public concern and a pretty substantial influence on health. But they are not traditional areas where public health has been very, very deeply involved or in the lead. We've done more perhaps around environmental quality with the focus on the human health effects of environmental issues like air pollution, for example, or other toxins in the environment. But I think the built environment is an area where we are going to be getting more and more engaged and should be getting engaged in informing the decisions about how we build our communities, because they affect not only how physically active people are, but they also affect many of these other factors that are on here as well. At yesterday's breakfast, we had a panel discussion, and Commissioner Scooten from Washington County was there and talked a lot about active transportation and what an important tool this could be for achieving not just health ends, but many other positive outcomes as well. I think public health has a lot to contribute to those debates, and really, just as when you evaluate some kind of transportation project, you want to look at its financing, you want to look at whether it's feasible, and you know, what impacts it's going to have on the community in a variety of ways, we should also be thinking about what is the impact of this potential project on health, and I think that's something that we can help inform some of those discussions in the public health world. So that's the way these rankings were constructed. If you look at the rankings themselves, there are some counties, as with all rankings, some counties are at the top of the list, some counties are at the bottom of the list. There were a few surprises for me as I looked through this. One, I was surprised, I think, of Multnomah County and Portland as being one of the more affluent areas of our state, and I was quite interested to see that it ranked 21st here. And I think that what you see in that example is that you know, there are places where Multnomah County does very well, but there are also other issues that even Multnomah County has to deal with. Similarly, if you looked at Benton County, which was number one, and looked at if you were to choose one of the other ones, Jefferson County, for example, which is number 33, even Jefferson County, for example, ranked very high on the physical environment score, even though their overall rank put them at the bottom here. So what's the point? I mean, who cares whether you're number one or number 33, besides just wounding your pride? Okay, we all have some of that. I think this is a good way to open the discussion, and my ask to you is that you work with us at State Public Health, and since you all have in some sense, are local officials as well, since you answer to your local constituents, that you work with the county public health, local public health departments in the counties that you represent, to figure out what are the things that are driving the rankings in your area and what are the possibilities you have to address those. So I think with that, I'm going to stop and turn the microphone over to Jenny, who's going to talk some about her experience at the local health department level, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jenny Leonard. I'm the administrator from Umatilla County Public Health. Thank you, Representative Tomei and members of the committee, for allowing us to come and visit with you about this. My job today is to explain a little bit about what this looks like at a local level and what we're doing and our strengths and our challenges. I won't say weaknesses, because I think that that's not an accurate picture of what's really happening. So, excuse me. So, our public health is affected by the communities in which we live. Policies and programs implemented by the public health department and our partners can improve and help in affecting our health, as well as our long-term, out-term goals. Umatilla County ranked number 16 in our overall health outcomes. And in our health factors, we ranked 30 out of 33. So I think it's important to note in those rankings that in the health factors, they looked at healthy behaviors, which was 32, clinical care, number 29, social and economics, 21, and our physical environment was number 9. So looking at these numbers, it'd be pretty easy for us to feel a little dejected and a little discouraged in Umatilla County, but I think it's important for you to know that it is a great place to live and work. While these numbers highlighted the areas that we can do better, it also highlighted the areas that we're doing well. Umatilla County is the 13th largest county here in the state of Oregon. We cover over 3,200 square miles. We have 12 cities and over 72,000 residents. 10,000 of our folks live in poverty. Our median income is about $40,000 for a family. 60% of that population is 18 to 64, 25% is 65 and older, and the rest make up the 18 and younger crowd. Our strengths come in many areas. We have a strong background with our community partners and a deep desire to make a difference in the places where we work and live. The county health rankings noted that our morbidity, or our quality of life, is ranked at number 15, while our mortality, or length of life, is ranked at number 16. This most likely is due in part to our physical environment that is comprised of clean air and access to healthy foods. Umatilla County is one of the largest wheat and pea industries in the nation. In addition, we have other agricultural commodities that include potatoes, vegetables, fruits, and seed crops. So some of the challenges that were noted in the health rankings, and well known, quite frankly, by my department, we're within the header of healthy behaviors. That study looks specifically at adult smoking, adult obesity, binge drinking, motor vehicle death rates, teen births, and the chlamydia rate. So Umatilla County has today, in last year's statistics, reported 13,402 adults that admit to smoking regularly. 2,775 people suffer from serious illnesses caused by tobacco, and we lost 142 county residents last year to tobacco-related death. We spend a whopping $22 million on our medical care related to tobacco illnesses, and over $23 million was lost in the productivity due to tobacco illness and death. So I guess the question is, well, what are we doing? Well, why those statistics that I mentioned feel like a loss, I can tell you we're making a difference. With the funding that we receive currently, we employ a tobacco coordinator who has worked diligently to implement a 25-foot ban from smoking within doors, windows, and air intakes in all county-owned buildings. Additionally, we worked with the City of Pendleton to create a ban on free tobacco samples. So that was a huge win for Umatilla County. The obesity rate is growing nationally. In my county, the majority of individuals travel from place to place by a car. We don't have a county or a any kind of city public transportation. And quite frankly, the majority or a large percentage of our residents live in a distance far enough away that it wouldn't be feasible for them to walk or ride a bike to get to where they need to go. Cities have worked to promote physical activity through our river walk or walking and biking paths that circulate around our parks. Public health has made a difference in that by creating a wellness committee. The mission of the committee is to educate and promote our employees to have a healthier lifestyle and to be aware of the existing benefits that are currently offered within the county. The committee sponsors a Get Active event every year. It's well received. Basically what it is it's an activity monitoring kind of nudge. I walked 45 minutes today. How far did you go? It can be very friendly, and at the end, the public health department then sponsors for the winning team a healthy barbecue or a healthy luncheon. Unfortunately, this hasn't been extended beyond the county because we don't have the fiscal availability to make that so. Living in Umatilla County also incorporates some of the great Out West traditions. We're a rodeo community. We have the wildlife cowboy shows. We have ranching, horseback riding. All those are really great historic things that occur and things that are associated with the communities and where I reside. Unfortunately, what accompanies that are chew tobacco and binge drinking. Alcohol use amongst our teens is an ongoing problem. And in our Healthy Teen Survey, we found that 37.6% of 8th graders report to having had their first drink before they were 13. 33% of those 8th graders have drank or admit to having drank in the last 30 days. And 14% of them admit to having 5 or more drinks in the last 30 days. Our teen pregnancy rate for girls 15 to 17 is 32.6 per 1,000. That's a statistic according to the DHS Family Planning Fact Sheet for 2008. Any unintended pregnancy isn't acceptable, and it's doubly so when it happens to a teenager. Public health provides confidential family planning services in our communities as well as classes in all of our school districts. We offer classes such as birth control, safe relationships, STI, HIV, AIDS classes, parenting classes, and the Baby Think It Over. The health department is also an active member in RAP, and that's the Reduce Adolescent Pregnancy Partnership. This is a coalition of community partners, and we're taking an active role in reducing teen pregnancy rate through a comprehensive approach of community education, advocacy, family planning, service development, and enhancement. Our chlamydia rate between our clientele of 15 to 24 is increasing. Last year we had 200 known cases, and we expect 2009 to have a higher number than that. We are continuing to educate our clients that come to the clinic, and again, offering those same educations in our school systems. Umatilla County has many partners working on creating a healthier environment for our residents. It's not just the role of public health to implement these policy changes. As I mentioned previously, we've had city and county government involvement, local groups and coalitions. Additionally, our local hospitals and our medical communities and local business owners are all equally engaged. It's going to take the whole village to create this healthy environment, and public health is just but a single spoke in that wheel. So I do appreciate the findings in this county health ranking, and while the report could leave some county health professionals feeling a bit defeated. My colleagues and I are looking at this as an opportunity to highlight what we're doing that is working well and the areas that where we can direct more attention. Ideally, this report will mobilize us as not only as individual counties, but as a state to make important changes needed to provide Oregonians with the healthiest communities to live in. So, thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting report and some startling statistics. Yes, Representative.
Two questions. Thank you for bringing this report before us. Thank you, Chair Tomei. The microenvironments within Multnomah County, I know that there are three counties that are looking at doing some national work with the ACHIEVE effort out of the CDC. I don't know if you know about that. They are looking at specific communities. I think it's the Native American communities in Jefferson County and some low-income folks in Columbia County and African-American communities in Multnomah County. Are you able to take this data and break it down into those microenvironments, or those particular communities, those populations? Because it's clear that there are some significant issues within particular populations.
Chair Tomei, Representative Frederick, the data that are in here, I didn't actually compile this report, or our staff didn't actually compile this report. This came from it came out of University of Wisconsin. You raise a very important issue, though. The data sources that I think have informed this work, we work very hard to collect enough data so that we can break this down by various communities, racial and ethnic communities, urban-rural divide, across the urban-rural divide as well. And I think that is a very, very important aspect of our work. And let me give you one example around tobacco and the tobacco disparities that I think really very, very important. So we know that tobacco use in Oregon, about 17% of adults currently are smokers now. We know that the rate in the African-American community is about 1.5 that, maybe even a little more than that. In the Native American community, it's even greater, twice or more. And we also know that people who earn under $15,000 a year smoke at three times the rate of people who earn over $45,000 a year. Cigarettes cost $5 a pack. That's a huge toll on anybody, but particularly if your finances are tight. But this is a very addictive substance. So, okay, we see these disparities. What do they mean, and how do we address them? I think what we have tried to do with respect to the racial and ethnic communities is to work with community leaders to address these issues in ways that are culturally competent and appropriate. And let me give you an example that may seem obvious, but in the Native American community, there's a whole tradition of sacred tobacco use. So how do we talk about not smoking cigarettes in a way that respects that tradition and doesn't, you know, turn people off from the get-go by telling them that their tradition is, you know, somehow bad or something to be frowned upon? So we work with community leaders to do that. I think it's a challenge for us to do because the resources are stretched thin, but I think very, very important. Similarly, around the low-income population, we actually have been working within DHS to get all of the divisions within DHS, who, of course, touch people, low-income people every day in a variety of ways, to integrate some tobacco prevention work into their activities. And we were just successful in, we were one of, I believe it was 15 states, 15 grantees to receive some funding out of the ARA funding for prevention and wellness specifically to advance that work. Some of it is very almost obvious in a way. If somebody is going to a website, for example, to sign up for services or to get information about services, to just have a button on the website that says, you know, are you a smoker? Did you know this is what it's costing you? And here's how you can get some help to quit. Not everybody's going to click that button, of course, but we know actually that most smokers want to quit. So the more they hear that message, the easier it is for them to take that first step, the more likely it is that we're going to get them down that road. So I think we have more to do in that arena for all of the health disparities that we have to deal with. And I certainly would love to have further conversation with you for ideas that you have about how we might address it.
I hope to as well. My second question, if you don't mind, it involves the fact that you have all this information, but it's not as well communicated to the communities. And that is my concern. I discovered a fresh food desert in my neighborhood, in my community, that I didn't realize was in fact a fresh food desert. The description is basically based around the idea that you have to go a number of blocks in order to find a grocery store that has something more than lemons. for something that for drinks. It's not a convenience store of some form. You are, in fact, getting a fresh food in an area. And in Northeast Portland, close to us, if you go to Mississippi Avenue, there is lots of nice boutiques, but there's no grocery store within quite a few blocks. And it's a surprise, but that also says that the folks who are living there don't get a chance to get fresh food on a regular basis, unless it's at a farmer's market that shows up at certain times during the year. Yeah. Communicating that concept to groups beyond the health officials, beyond the city officials, is an important factor. How are you able to do that? Are you able to do that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Frederick, I think this is a great example. I will tell you, we don't have any state general fund investment in obesity prevention in our health department. So the ability of us to communicate and try to support whatever action the community would want to take around that is very much constrained by that. We squeeze little bits and pieces out from here and there, but I think you're absolutely right. Data like that, crafted in a way that people can hear and that moves them to action, is very, very powerful and sort of the first step in moving down that road. I mean, there the ways to address the food desert issue, a whole lot of policy ways to do that, and some sort of community activist ways to do that as well. We would love an opportunity to do a better job at communicating that to people and to policymakers.
Thank you.
We're going to have to move on. Is there any last quick question?
Okay. Madam Chair, the website goes into great detail about all the data. It's quite interesting.
And do we have the website on here?
It's countyhealthrankings.org.
Oh, I see. Great. Good.
Much more detail than I wanted.
That is quite a statement.
Madam Chair, can I ask one quick question?
Of course.
Thank you. Dr. Cohen, we got the word the other day that tobacco revenue proceeds are up last year, higher than was anticipated. I mean, it's great to have a little more revenue, but from that source, we'd rather not. Do you have any idea of why the revenue is higher than had been anticipated, especially during a year of a recession? You know, you would have thought it might have gone the other way. What's going on?
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembrough, I think what's going on is that this is a product that's actively promoted. So there's lots of pressure to encourage people to smoke. And also at times of economic crisis, this is a stress-reducing drug in many ways. So I suspect those are two things that are driving that. Last session, because of the projection in tobacco revenues that was actually a fall in projections, the projection was that the revenues were going to fall. Our tobacco program sustained a very substantial cut. I mean, nobody actually cut us, but there was a huge drop, I think on the order of 15 or 20% of our revenue. And this affects our program. I think our programming is very effective at countering some of that active marketing of these products. And interestingly, we tried to spread that as effectively, to minimize the damage that would do across all of the components of our program. But one place where we had to take some money from that I think we felt really bad was from the county activities to do just the kinds of things that Representative Frederick is talking about and that Jenny just told you about. Umatilla, by the way, has really been a star around tobacco prevention. They've done some really terrific things there. So, the fall in funding, the fall in support for those activities, I think is part of the reason why we have an increase in smoking.
And I think prevention, we've learned that, I think, in this committee, that prevention in any of these unhealthy habits is so much more effective than trying to take care of them after someone is addicted. So thank you for working on that. Tough job, but thank you for coming today. Thank you, Mel. It's always good to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. With that, we will close the informational hearing on the Robert Wood Johnson Report on County Health Rankings in Oregon and open up an informational meeting on domestic violence. And I think we have two panels. The Honorable Maureen McKnight, Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge, and Chris Bilhart, Director of Volunteers of America Home Free, and Jane Downing, Executive Director of Mid Valley Women's Crisis Center. And I would remind folks, please turn off your cell phones, your blackberries, blueberries, strawberries, any kind of berries that you have, because it affects the sound system here. Welcome. So glad you're here. Thank you for coming.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to all of you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. I've been asked to start. My name is Maureen McKnight. I'm a circuit court judge in Multnomah County. I've been on the bench for about 8 years, and my primary assignment is in the family court. So I handle all of the standard divorce, custody, parenting time, those kinds of issues. But I also have an assignment in our domestic violence court, so I'm also handling criminal matters. I do the domestic violence misdemeanor cases, so assault in the fourth degree, strangulation, menacing, interference with making reports, and also restraining order violations. And prior to taking the bench, I practiced family law and handled a lot of cases for domestic violence victims. I wanted to clarify, though, that I'm speaking here today not for the Judicial Department or any other group or entity other than myself. I feel strongly about domestic violence, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk to you all. I really wanted to concentrate on two sort of major themes. One are the recent domestic violence fatalities that we've had here in Oregon, and the second, some of the themes that I think are significant in how communities respond to domestic violence. I believe you have a handout, a landscape document in front of you. This is prepared by staff in the Domestic Violence Coordinator's Office in Multnomah County. It's not an official document. It's gleaned from newspaper accounts. And I think that's probably the first point I wanted to make, is that we don't have official centralized record keeping on domestic violence. We have individual entities and agencies that keep their own data and share that, you know, as needed. But we don't do a good job in this state of collating and analyzing information at a statewide level. So what you have in this chart, you can see from the front page, just tells you that over the last 14 months, we've had 22 victims of domestic violence in this state and 13 perpetrators who have taken their own lives. Actually, that was in 2009. In 2010, we had eight, so far we've had eight victims and two perpetrators. So we have a 14-month period here that, in a moment, as I compare to what the data has been from the good study that we have from the past, we have a significant increase. Of these 29 cases that are outlined there on your chart, I wanted to highlight just some pieces that we've extracted from it to sort of set the stage. Two of the murders took place in the victim's workplace. In 10 of the cases, 10 of the 29, the partners were separating or divorcing, and we know not just from Oregon data but from national data that this is a time of increased danger, a very substantial increase in danger. Two of the cases, the victims had obtained restraining orders. In 15 of the cases, firearms were used. The criminal justice system was involved in two of the cases, that is, there was already involvement. And in one of the cases, child welfare had already removed the child from the home because one or more of the parents was not able to protect or was causing violence. And I mentioned that this is an increase. The Department of Human Services, through their health components, did a pretty solid 7-year study that ended in 2003, and there were 124 homicides in an intimate partner context over the 7-year period that that study controlled, and that's an average of approximately 18 per year. When you look at the data that we have, and again, this is not this is newspaper gleaned material. It's not firsthand look at the reports. What we have in 2009 is a 22% increase over that average that had existed in the 7-year study. And if you factor in the numbers just for 2010 alone, you're looking and look at a whole 14-month period, you're looking at well over a 40% increase. We don't know that the numbers in the first 7 weeks of this year are going to be sustained in terms of fatalities. And but my point is, even if you look at the 22% increase, it's not just tragic, it's absolutely staggering in terms of what's going on. There are quite a few positive things that are happening with domestic violence in communities and how we're addressing them. One thing, frankly, is our legislation. We have very good, sound laws on domestic violence here. We've, for the last 30 years, we've had restraining order legislation that's actually been at the forefront and copied in other jurisdictions. We have presumptions against granting custody, child custody, to parents who are violent. We have criminal statutes that address enhanced penalties in some domestic violence situations, and we have some data coding that's been required by statute to allow prosecutors to code cases for domestic violence internally in their records. We have appropriations for victim services, and recently the legislature has enacted housing and workplace protections. And outside that legislative arena, we have statewide standards for batterer intervention treatment programs. And what's happening now is that a number of communities, some led by courts, some by other entities in some communities, are looking at whether we can differentiate among types of batterers and offenders, and if so, how can we tailor our interventions more effectively, not just in sentencing, though that's a big piece, but more effectively among the various portals in the community where victims or perpetrators might come into contact. Another positive thing I think that's going on is that in some communities we have multidisciplinary councils where individuals from various perspectives and agencies regularly meet to discuss domestic violence issues, to share their local data. For example, in Multnomah County, one of the things we routinely do is to vet grant applications to various funders to make sure that we've looked at things from a system basis and, well, one entity getting this funding impact negatively, you know, the whole system's response to it. So you have typically in counties that have those councils, everyone from prosecutors and corrections to the courts to victim service organizations, probation, clergy, health, health child welfare. I'm sure I'm missing some very prominent members, but those are just examples. In Multnomah County, our council's been in existence for about 23 years, and in addition to some of the activities I've mentioned, members of the council, and I don't do this because of my role as a judge, but participate in the county budget process to rank and prioritize the domestic violence proposals that are submitted to local funders, and to look at all of those from a systemic perspective. And I think, having been involved with this council since its inception back in 1987, I feel really confident in saying that three things have sustained that council, and one is funding and having staff to help us, funding equaling staff in that context. And we have local government leadership who's committed to the issue of domestic violence, not just funding, but to a systemic look and regular updates about the issue. And we have developed a real history of collaboration, I think, in our county, of working to not just discussing, but working together on the issues. One more positive thing that I wanted to mention for you that is going on are the fatality reviews. In 2005, the legislature authorized the creation of local interdisciplinary teams that would meet to assess, debrief the circumstances in domestic violence fatalities. Most communities lack funding to actually implement that legislation. We've been fortunate in Multnomah County for the reasons that I've said that we've been able to do some of those fatality reviews, and we have recommendations that we share locally among us and track and try to keep tabs on. And while this is helpful at a local level, I think we're missing an opportunity statewide. If other communities aren't also able to do those fatalities, we're not able to pool the information to see if what Multnomah County is finding is typical or happened in a review is also happening in Klamath Falls, or maybe there's a law change that's needed. We're not able, again, to sort of centralize and share that information. So that was an element I wanted to bring to you all as policymakers. In my own role from the bench, I see domestic violence in a number of contexts, in restraining order cases, in child custody matters, criminal cases, as I've said, in juvenile court where the state has had to step in through the Department of Human Services because a parent can't protect the child. And what's significant in terms of the court's perspective on that, and again, I think my colleagues would very much agree with me on this, is that we very often see the same families having multiple interactions with the court. So that it would be not just a juvenile case, but there's also a restraining order and a divorce at the same time, and maybe also a criminal or probation case going on. And it might not involve just those partners, the current partners, but also the perpetrator's past partners. So you have a series of individuals who've been involved with the same person and a number of court cases going on. That multiplicity of cases and relationships is one of the reasons it's so critically important for judges to be consistent in their orders, to know what other judges have done for the same family, to know what the background of the family is. And I wanted to mention that I think the most significant improvement in judicial response to domestic violence will be the implementation of e-court that would give me access on my bench, not just to files that are downstairs in the first floor of the courthouse that I have to send my staff to get, but to know what's happened in other counties and to be able to pull those up instead of knowing I simply don't have access to it. And being better informed means that I can make that kind of individualized response to a case that is needed, because one of the, I think, absolute sort of prime imperatives in domestic violence in the field is that there really is no one-size-fits-all response. You have to tailor to the situation. You have to tailor to the relationship. And the situation is always in flux. So in my mind, what we need to be doing as a state is making sure that we have multiple avenues for victims to be contacting us. We know that over 90% of victims do reach out for help, but they reach out at different times to different entities. We know that family and friends are the most commonly accessed resource. Police, mental health providers, workplace supervisors and coworkers. I'm sort of giving you the descending tier that Oregon studies have shown. Clergy, courts, legal services and family law lawyers, shelters and crisis lines. It's because there are such a number of ways where victims do reach out, it's so important that all of those portals are informed and able to give accurate information to victims so that they're able to make their own best choices about their own safety. So as, you know, really as sobering as these statistics are, or these reading these short vignettes of what's happened recently, I'm really hopeful that the discussions today can help generate some momentum. I know it's not just this committee, but there are other groups around the state that are struggling to learn from the recent tragedies. And I'm hopeful for a renewed commitment, not just locally, but at the highest levels here at the state. So I really want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions now or later on easy to find in email.
Since I think we're going to hold our questions for the end of this panel, if that's all right with the committee. And I think floor session is at 10:15 today. Is there any reason why you can't stay until 10:15? Representative Maurer.
Yes, Madam Chair. I have to leave at 9:30.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I have 10 o'clock real quick.
Okay. All right. We'll try to get as much done as we can.
I have to leave about 5 till 10 as well.
Okay, we'll try to go through this as quickly as we can. This is such an important material. I really want us to get as much of it as we can.
I just want to, Madam Chair, just recognize you mentioned the issue on E-Court, and that is so important. I mean, if you don't get it, I remember days down in Lane County when you had the district court and circuit court, and you go and get a restraining order, and none of the court judges knew what was going on throughout the whole. And what you're doing up there is just great. So.
Good. Okay, we're going to move on because and some of these people we might have to ask to come back again during the interim, but we'll get through this. We have two more presenters here, and then we have another panel of three, so we'll get through as much as we can. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me, Chair Tomei and committee members. My name is Chris Bilhart, and I'm the director of Home Free, which is a victim services program operated by the Volunteers of America Oregon in Portland. And I'm going to be talking with you for a few minutes about housing issues that domestic violence survivors face. A woman called our domestic violence hotline a couple of months ago. She had fled her abusive partner, but she, unfortunately, this is a very common situation in our community, couldn't find an open shelter bed anywhere in our community. She was unwilling to return to her partner. She was really going to try to stay away. So she was calling us to see if we had any tips for her about a safe bridge she could sleep under. Also, a while back, our Safe Start advocate, who works providing domestic violence advocacy services within one of the child welfare branches in the Portland area, began work with a domestic violence survivor who'd been reported to the child abuse hotline when she was discovered to be living in an abandoned building with her 9-year-old daughter. It was not a place that was suitable for habitation. She explained to her advocate that when she and her daughter had left the abuser, they had nowhere else to go, and she had chosen that particular location, that abandoned building, because from there she was able to maintain her daughter's school attendance at her home school, and that meant a lot to her daughter and maintained some sense of normalcy in her life. That domestic violence survivors, though, are faced with these kinds of choices every day in our state, even in the face of all of our considerable efforts, shows how far we have yet to go. Adequate, safe, and accessible housing options are critical to the safety of survivors and their children in all stages of their flight from and movement towards freedom from domestic violence. Emergency housing, such as shelter and motel vouchers, transitional housing, longer-term housing that can be an important bridge out of crisis, and safe and affordable permanent housing all have something in common. They're crucial elements in the ability of survivors to escape the violence. They improve health. They provide protection against further victimization. And they should be there. Leaving an abusive relationship can be a highly dangerous act, as Judge McKnight already mentioned. This is when homicides are more likely to occur. When these housing options I referred to a minute ago and the support and advocacy and specialized services that domestic violence programs can provide in accompaniment are not available, survivors are faced with just really impossible choices, such as sleeping under a bridge. Staying with family and friends whose location may be known to the abuser, and it's only a matter of time before she's found there. Or just staying home, not leaving, and enduring attack after attack. When domestic violence survivors are looking for emergency housing, they typically have either just experienced violence or they know that they're about to. They can sense it building. And so their need and crisis is immediate and urgent. But they need to be able to arrange to get to a shelter safely. And this is often a huge barrier in rural and frontier communities, traveling to a shelter. They need to be able to find a shelter with room for them, and this is often the huge barrier in the urban centers in our state. And they need to be able to find a safe place to go when their shelter stay is up. This is a barrier everywhere. The DV shelter system is under immense strain when families who face barriers to accessing housing, families face barriers to accessing housing after a shelter stay. Add to this subset of survivors, those who actually do make it to a shelter, the even larger number of survivors that are struggling with makeshift living arrangements and precarious housing stability, and the statistics make sense that 38% of all domestic violence survivors experience homelessness at some point, that as many as 50% of women who are homeless identify domestic violence as the main cause of their homelessness, and that 46% of homeless women stayed in abusive relationships because they had nowhere to go. Where do survivors and children who leave their abusers go when they leave? Most make the best temporary arrangements that they can, which can include shelter, a good option, family, motel, living out of their car, some less good options. Then what? Best case, if they're able to access informed support, financial assistance, or employment, and have a strong network of safety built around them, they can go on to achieve new housing and establish themselves independently of the abuser. But for many survivors, it's not that easy. There's a significant correlation between housing instability and an increased risk of lethal violence in abusive relationships. Yet finding and keeping housing is one of the greatest barriers faced by women who leave abusers. Domestic violence impacts many aspects of survivors' lives that can increase the risk of poverty and homelessness. The lasting impacts of trauma, prolonged isolation from social supports, that's pretty typical in most abusive relationships, damage to their credit, their rental history, their employment prospects, ongoing stalking by the abuser, ongoing court involvement as a result of the abuse, and the considerable supports needed by their children combined to represent the proverbial long haul in this journey. After the immediate crisis is somewhat stabilized, transitional housing programs for domestic violence survivors can provide a medium-term length of stay with many built-in supports such as groups, children's services, help with credit repair and employability skills, and even an opportunity to begin establishing a positive rental history. These programs can be facility-based, so they're owned or leased by a domestic violence program that allows survivors and their children to stay temporarily while they get a fix on more permanent housing. Or they can be what's called transition-in-place models, where the survivor is helped to obtain housing in her own name and provided with support and financial subsidy until she can sustain the costs herself and it becomes her permanent housing. Rent assistance alone is not enough. We know this. A recent study found that housing vouchers not paired with special interventions may not be effective. The specialized knowledge and support provided by domestic violence programs, when coupled with financial and housing assistance, works enormously well. Women who are linked with advocates during the post-crisis period report higher quality of life, more social supports, and less re-abuse. So it works. In Home Freeze Housing, our housing program, we use a transition-in-place model, so we help people get apartments and help support them until they can sustain the apartments on their own. 86% of the survivors we contact after exiting the program are still in safe housing a year later, and that's a pretty good result. The woman I referred to earlier, the one in the abandoned building, is one of those women. She and her daughter were able to stay together, working with DHS and our advocate, attending counseling, getting established in a job, and eventually doing just fine, the two of them, together in their own apartment with running water and electricity and heat, and lots of gratitude that there was no more cause to cower and hide and duck and run.
Chris, I'm going to ask you to wrap it up a little bit.
I am. Here's my final paragraph. There's one more commonality about these different types of housing that are so critical to safety and stabilization of DV survivors in our state. There's not enough of it. There's not enough shelter beds. There's not enough affordable housing units, not enough flexible funding that allows us to remove some of the financial barriers that can really make the difference between safety, security, and dignity that stable housing can provide and the terror and vulnerability of living under the same roof with an abuser. And after 12 years of piloting and refining our own housing program, we're true believers in the power of a roof over your head in helping us move closer to ending domestic violence. And we're anxious to further discuss these issues with you and at any level in our state.
Thank you, Chris.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Jane Downing, and I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service. And I've been working with victims and survivors of domestic and sexual violence for 19 years. Started out as a crisis line volunteer, and now I've been the executive director for a little over 12 years. And I just want to say on behalf of all programs like ours, how much we appreciate the support from all of you to help try to provide services through our program. So I'm going to say that, and then I'm going to be very brief talking about some of the responses around domestic violence in the workplace. Judge McKnight told you, there's been two of the domestic violence homicides in the last 3 months that have taken place in the workplace. And so it's very important for us to understand that domestic violence just doesn't stay within the home. It happens in the workplace, not just in homicides, but also in people coming into the workplace and saying, I'm not sure where to go. Sometimes the workplace is the only safe place for those individuals, the only place where they feel like they can talk to someone. And so giving them some skills and understanding within the workplace for managers, supervisors, and co-workers is one of the most important things that we can do in our communities. And the state of Oregon has been taking a look at that in the last couple of years. The governor signed an order requiring all managers, supervisors, and HR employees to have mandatory training on domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking in the workplace. To date, we've trained almost 5,000 managers and state employees around the state of Oregon. I've primarily been doing the bulk of those trainings, and the response to that has been absolutely incredible. As you know, domestic violence costs about $35 million in cost, estimated costs in the workplace each year. And so you have a situation where if all employers were doing something around this issue, it could make a huge difference. And I want to tell you about some of the ways in which we've seen that. When these committees were brought together, it was a wide range of individuals to decide how that policy was going to look for the state of Oregon. Boley was involved in that, Attorney General's office, many, many programs across the state, union representation, all of the folks coming together at the table and saying, how can we make a difference in the workplace? And one of the things that we've heard over and over, I can tell you from doing all those trainings, there's not been a single one of them, not one, where someone hasn't either come up to me during the training or after the training and said, this is happening to me, this is happening to someone in my workplace, this is happening to someone in my family. There's not been a single one without those kinds of disclosures. And that's, you know, managers saying that to me. And so I think while this has been unfunded, our program has been doing this for free. We're a very small program, so that's been a challenge. We know what a difference it's making, so we've been willing to do that. I want to say to you just a few quotes of what folks have said from those trainings. It has opened my eyes to a tragic social issue that crosses over to the workplace. I applaud the governor for the action he has taken by issuing this executive order. I initially thought this training was not necessary, as I hadn't had time to deal with domestic violence in the workplace, and I have been a manager for a long time. I changed my mind. I think this training is extremely valuable.
And then the number one comment that I want you all to know about, even though it's not been popular that these have been mandated trainings, the number one comment on all the evaluations is this should be open for everyone. This should be available for everyone. I want you to know these trainings have made a real difference in the lives of survivors. We've been able to go into the workplace and actually do safety planning with the managers and the staff around what to do if a perpetrator comes within the workplace. And that is happening. Perpetrators are using their resources in order to continue to stalk their victims. They also are coming into the workplace and threatening not only the managers but the co-workers of those individuals. And so one of the things that's happened with some of the legislation you did in the last one is you've encouraged workplaces in general, all workplaces, to take some steps to make some accommodations. Those are making a difference. Providing training, support to employers, all the different things that you've already done and maybe that we could work on together to do in the future will make a huge difference to victims of domestic violence in our state. I thank you for your efforts. I encourage you to continue those efforts. And if there's anything that we can do to help support you in that, I want you to know that we're there and we're willing to do that work. So thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much for coming. What I'd like to ask is, would you stay in the audience while we hear the next panel? If we have time, we'll bring you back up if there are questions specifically for you.
Definitely.
That would be great. Thank you. Now I have Lauren Polk, Deputy Chief Steve Belshaw, and Sybil Hebb. And one of the issues, and I'm not sure if it's anybody on this panel or if it's anybody in the building, I am a big proponent of prevention. If there's anyone can give me some idea of why this domestic violence is increasing at this time, and especially these deaths that we see, I mean, I can imagine the kind of domestic violence that is underlying all of these deaths that are leading to the worst possible outcome. If anybody can give this committee, and me in particular, any idea why domestic violence is increasing at this time, I would be so delighted. So, thank you. Go ahead, Lauren.
Thank you so much, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'm here to talk a little bit about prevention efforts that are already happening in Oregon and why I believe prevention is so important and integral to the safety of youth in Oregon. Teen dating violence, like domestic violence, is a serious public health problem. Teen dating violence, however, has the added danger of potentially
I'm sorry, Lauren. Yes. Could you identify yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sure. Sorry. My name's Lauren Polk. I'm a teen advocate with Volunteers of America Home Free.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you. Teen dating violence has the added danger of potentially having a serious impact on cognitive and emotional development. Statistics tell us that 1 in 3 Oregon youth are affected by teen dating violence, many of them as young as age 11, and 2/3 of these youth will never report their experiences. In a recent national survey, 1 in 4 tweens ages 11 to 14 reported that physical abuse is a serious problem in their relationships. Over 1 in 3 reported that verbal abuse is a serious problem in their relationships. Despite these statistics, only half of the tweens identified that they could talk about warning signs for domestic violence and dating violence within their relationships. The survey goes on to identify that these abusive behaviors only increase as the teens get older. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention has identified healthy relationship education as vital to preventing teen dating violence. Considering that experiencing violence as a teen makes you more susceptible to experiencing violence as an adult, the CDC has also stated that teen dating violence prevention is directly correlated to preventing domestic violence in adult relationships. Unfortunately, Oregon public schools do not currently require healthy relationship education in middle and high schools. While prevention awareness efforts are happening in many counties in Oregon, including Lane, Washington, Multnomah, Clackamas, Curry, and Josephine counties, in many cases, these efforts are not school-wide, and therefore they're not reaching all students. Additionally, healthy relationship educators like me are often not allowed the time with the students that is required to develop behavioral and attitudinal changes around teen dating violence. The CDC recommends 7 to 9 contacts for providing primary prevention. Since 72% of teens report having been already in a relationship by age 14, it's really important that we get this information to teens way earlier than high school. Teens themselves often identify the need and desire for healthy relationship education. I've done countless presentations, and over again, I'm heartened by the engagement teens have with the information that I'm presenting to them, and their hunger for hearing about healthy relationships in an in-depth way. The questions they ask around abuse, legality, communication, and consent tell me that this information is not getting to them when it should, because most of their questions are formed based on their personal experiences within their current and past relationships. I'm saddened by the normalizing of jealousy, possession, and mistrust in teen relationships. However, I know that long-term contact makes a difference. For example, teens who participate in support groups, which require long-term contact, often identify that they learned a lot of new information. And in fact, on more than one occasion, teens have expressed to me that they think everyone should be required to learn about healthy relationship, abuse, gender roles, and the many other subjects included in the curriculum that I present. One of the teens that I work with told me that she wished that every girl could come to support group. Part of what she was expressing there is that every youth deserves access to long-term healthy relationship education. Since dating violence is correlated with other health issues like eating disorders, self-harm behavior, sexually risky behavior, and substance abuse, the prevention of dating violence is integral to the overall safety of Oregon youth. Thank you, Chair Tomei and committee members, for your time.
Thank you very much. That's great.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, representatives. My name is Steve Belshaw. I'm Deputy Chief of Police for the Criminal Investigations Division for the Salem Police Department. I've been a police officer for over 20 years, most of my time involved in investigating sexual assault and crimes against persons. As a police officer, we are taught from day one to be wary of domestic violence calls. We're taught that domestic violence calls are the most dangerous calls a police officer can go on. These types of calls are highly emotional and charged with hostility in an environment where a victim can quickly turn on an officer in a blink of an eye. We're taught that the majority of officers who are injured on the job are injured in domestic violence calls. And we're taught that of any call that we go on that can likely result in the death of another person, it's a domestic violence call. Salem Police Department had a time of a five-year period where we investigated 12 domestic violence calls that were homicides that took the lives of some of our citizens. And we realized that there was something we needed to do to address that. We needed a program that would offer a more complete response to domestic violence calls and that would result in increased prosecution and provide immediate intervention for victims and decrease the chances of responding to multiple victims. We realized that this was a problem that we could not solve ourselves. We could not arrest our way out of this problem. We needed a vision to have an integrated team within the department with advocates who could respond immediately. A grant proposal from the Violence Against Women Act funds provided us with an advocate that responds 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on scene with officers to provide immediate services to the victims. We now have a full-time advocate, a part-time advocate, and 16 volunteers that are willing to take pager shifts and get called out in the middle of the night to respond with our officers to provide services to victims of domestic violence. Those advocates also provided ongoing training for our officers, but that wasn't enough. We needed to train our officers to do a good job. We went to our patrol officers, officers that are already overworked and responding to multiple calls day in and day out, and said, we want you to do more. We asked for officers, and 15 of our officers volunteered to get specialized training in responding to domestic violence calls and be the ones that went to these calls that are most likely the most dangerous calls for service that they're going to go on. These officers responded. We asked them to go to a two-hour meeting every month. And that meeting, we asked them to come out of their comfort zone. The meeting every month, they meet with the DAs who prosecute their cases. They meet with our advocates from our department. They meet with our Women's Crisis Service, the folks that provide services and shelter to our victims, and they meet with the parole and probation officers every month. Having that interaction with these officers day in and day out to look at our cases, to review the cases, to improve our investigations, to write better reports, to do complete investigations, and to hold people accountable from the time of the call through the court, and then when they go back into the community, has been like night and day for us. Over the course of the last 10 years since we've been doing this, our officers have investigated more cases. We've seen the DA's office has now assigned prosecutors that do nothing but domestic violence cases so that they are seeing these offenders. Parole and probation officers who used to mix the DV offenders throughout their caseloads now have DV parole and probation officers that do nothing but specialize and track these offenders. The results have been great for us. We've seen in the calls for service for the average police department, the domestic violence calls take 9 to 15% of their call load. Their total call load is between 9 and 15%. And in instituting this program where we hold people accountable and we do that, last year our total call load for domestic violence was 5% of our total calls, down from 9%. So we're holding people accountable and we're seeing less offenders. In a period of time from 1992 through 2004, we investigated 26 homicides that were domestic violence related. Since instituting this program, the city of Salem has not investigated domestic violence homicide since 2004. By partnering with our on a regular basis with our DV prosecutors, our officers know what's expected in a good investigation. Our prosecution rate has gone up to 83% of our cases are filed by our DV prosecutors, which is a phenomenal rate of doing this and getting these people accountable. In conclusion, what we are doing, we are extremely proud of. We've accomplished a lot for very little money, but we're asking overworked officers for no extra pay to do a lot more. We're proud of what we've done, but we also have the feeling that we're the little boy standing in front of the dam with his finger in the hole, and that there's a lot more to come. We cannot do this alone. Our partners, like I said, we can't arrest our way out of this. We need our prosecutors. We need our women's shelter. We need our parole and probation officers. And most of all, what would be a great day for me would be to be able to be a part of a sweeping change for prevention, like the chairman said, because I would like to go back to my chief and say our domestic violence team has outlived its purpose. We have resolved this, and we don't need to have a specialized team anymore. It is not a problem in our community, and we can disband this team, but we're not there yet. So, again, there are good things out there, but this is a bigger problem than law enforcement, and it needs to your help and your leadership to demand specialized teams in dealing with this and prevention efforts that would keep us from having to deal with these things later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. It sounds like you've done a fantastic job. Sybil, I know you're the wrap-up here. Yeah. And again, if you can help us, and maybe this, we're not going to have time today, maybe we'll have to have another meeting. But I really want our committee to understand why this spate of domestic violence. We're talking a lot about how to deal with it, but how do we prevent it? What, having had a background in sociology, what is going on in our society that is sort of increasing these incidents of domestic violence? When, having gone, as a strong feminist, having gone through that 30, 40 years ago, it just blows me away. Why is this still happening to women? So.
Well, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, and I very much appreciate the question as well as the attention to this issue today and your past efforts. I think your questions are questions that we're all asking ourselves. There are some answers that we've come up with that we understand, and a lot that I think we still don't. What we have seen, unfortunately, is that the recent spate, the increase in fatalities, in lethality of incidences, has been reflected across the nation. There have been similar spikes in other states, and I think one of the things that we're seeing, or one of the connections that explains that, is the great increasing rate of unemployment. I don't mean to suggest by any means that unemployment causes domestic violence. That's not the case. But where there is unemployment and great stress in families, there's also greater access between victims and perpetrators. As Jane mentioned, the workplace can often be a safe place for victims. That's no longer available. Perpetrators without resources, without jobs to go to, are more likely to be in the home. And so we're seeing greater incidents of domestic violence as a correlation to unemployment, as well as a greater level of lethality. Another important factor in that analysis is that our safety structures are significantly limited. There's fewer financial resources. People are more in need of shelter being provided for free or housing that they can't afford. So there are fewer places to go. People are more in a position of, if they're deciding to leave, whether or not they're going to, as Chris explained, spend the night under a safe bridge or remain in the home that's abusive because they don't have another option. And so I think one of the themes that I'm charged with summarizing for you today is that aside from the need for greater resources in all of our realms, there's also a very important coordination factor and connection factor. And if a victim in the difficult decision, making the difficult decision about whether to leave, and if so, how to do that safely, if she has that help and coordination support going through that process, she's far more likely to achieve safe outcomes for herself and her children. And Chris described working with the woman who had been living in the abandoned building and providing that woman with a number of different resources and support such that she's now housed and her child's still in the same school and they're in a safe spot. And that involves the provision of legal resources in terms of getting restraining orders, making sure that there is an appropriate custody and parenting time provision in place, making sure that there's financial support such that housing can be paid for, and making sure that that housing is there. So I think the bottom line answer to your question is that we don't definitively know, but the two things that I think in our work that we've seen that are the most important factors there are, number one, the level of unemployment, but number two, and maybe most significantly, the need for coordination. And I think Oregon has done, as we've described, a really remarkable job of trying to enhance the response across the board, BOLI and the Department of Administrative Services and the Attorney General's Office and agencies, Department of Human Services, I have to express, has also really struggled with how to prioritize these cases. I think the missing piece is making sure that all of those efforts are informed and have a chance to look at the big picture and are coordinating at the state level in the same way that Steve described was successfully happening in Marion County and that Judge McKnight described was happening on the local level in Multnomah County. Where those coordinated looks occur, if they're taken by people who can then affect policy change as necessary, that's where the rubber really meets the road and we see change happening that will hopefully be preventive. So I want to echo the thanks that everyone has expressed. And I think the only other thing that I wanted to identify for the committee is that there are a number of agencies as well as policy leaders in the state struggling with how to respond to these fatalities. The governor has recently pulled together a group of agency directors as well as advocates and members of the schools and representatives of children's interests and asked them to come up with some recommendations as to what
short-term as well as long-term steps the state can take in prevention. And so we are currently meeting, and we expect to have recommendations by the end of March, and we hope that we'll have a chance to come back to this body and others to inform you about those recommendations and let you know about what next steps we hope to take.
That would be great. So
thank you.
It concerns me a great deal about what I'm hearing from you. So there is something pervasive in even the juvenile society that is somehow giving the message that it's all right to be abusive to young women.
That's what they say.
So it is. And, you know, I wonder if it doesn't have something to do with the issue that I think you and I are both concerned about, human trafficking. It's almost seems like that's of a piece, that this kind of attitude that somehow females can be used this way and used and abused this way. I know you have a question, Representative Doherty, and we have other people in both panels. If you have questions, we can ask them to come up. Representative Doherty.
As usual, my brief question, and this is for the Deputy Chief, is your program unique to Salem, or do other jurisdictions also have a similar program?
Our program is unique in the fact that we have advocates that respond 24/7. Mm-hmm. There are some agencies that have officers dedicated to domestic violence. Portland has a domestic violence unit. Ours is unique in the fact that we are training our patrol officers that are out there that are going to these calls. They act as resources to others. Hillsborough has started an advocacy program that they are modeling and have come down and talked to us about what we're doing. So they're working on theirs as well.
Could I have a quick follow-up question?
Yes.
Do other jurisdictions know about your program? Have you publicized it?
We have, and we've talked about it, we have invited other agencies. Marion County Sheriff's Office is getting ready to start a team, and they have started attending our monthly meetings, we have talked about it, and we try and to get that out at trainings, that there are some things that are effective for agencies that don't involve creating new units and adding officers, that you're using the existing resources.
Well, thank you. Obviously, it's a good program. It works, and you should be very proud of it.
Thank you.
Indeed.
Chair Tomei, Chair Tomei, Representative Doherty, I would just add that I think that one of the functions that the Crime Victim Services Division has at the Attorney General's Office has played is to try to, they administer grants. Some of those grants have, in some communities, managed to start up programs that are similar. What I think we're, and we think that they do a terrific job and really make a big difference. We're hopeful in the long run that we can have consistency of response in every community in the state, so that if you're a victim in Burns, Oregon, or Heppner, or Salem, you have the same access to coordination and a similar response. So, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to hold you because I've got a couple other questions. So Representative Boone, Denbrough, and Van Orman.
Did you want to go first?
No.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you all for all what you do. And Lauren, you're working at the front end of things. It's especially important. I guess what I'm seeing a missing piece here is and you have to focus on the victim. I understand that, and get them out into a safe place. What is happening to these perpetrators, in the time frame it takes to go through the legal system and the judicial system? They stay in the home, or, somebody, it just seems like it's backwards, that the victims have to leave and experience all this, scrambling around to find their resources and get help and stuff. But I'm guessing that because of the way, I'm not an attorney, so I maybe don't understand, but what happens to excuse me, I'm not trying to be sexist, but these guys that are doing this, are they just left in the home to wait for their trials, or what, if they even get a trial?
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, I think it's a great question, and that's certainly a piece of the response that we want to enhance. I think there's sort of two pieces, and I'll invite Steve and Judge McKnight to share their thoughts. But I think with respect to people who have interaction with the criminal justice system, that's one question. There are a number of cases that we know that never even make it to that point. And so I think, you know, that's part of the issue that we're looking at is how can we make sure that when a case happens, whether or not the criminal justice system is involved, we're prepared to address the safety issue. The accountability piece, I think Steve and Judge McKnight are best suited to address.
And we've tried to address some of those things. Typically, a stalking order hearing and a restraining order hearing are civil processes. We have encouraged our DV officers to attend those hearings if they think it would be appropriate and would help in the restraining order hearings to grant the exclusivity of the home to the victim rather than the suspect. But again, in these relationships, it's about who has power and control over the relationship. And a lot of times our victims do not have a job. They do not have the financial resources because the suspect has kept them from doing that. And so they don't have the ability to go and retain an attorney. He's the one that can retain the attorney and present very well because he is in control. And so those are things. Now, after it gets through the court process, another piece with our program in Marin County is we require batter intervention classes and programs that they have to deal with. And we're very clear, batter intervention is much different than anger management. If a person has anger problems, they're going to assault anybody and everybody that makes them mad, and these offenders are not doing that. They're choosing their victims, and they're choosing the times of when they assault them and assaulting them and injuring them in places that are not easily seen. So we have those batter intervention programs to hold those offenders accountable, and we found that to be effective as well.
Judge, did you have something?
Yes, thank you, Chair Tomei and Representative Boone. Just, I think, maybe three short points on that. I think, first of all, sort of what happens to the batterer, the perpetrator, depends on in what context either the victim or the batterer come to the attention of some part of the system. For example, a lot of what I do in the family law arena is making sure that if it's possible for that parent to still have safe contact with the children and not impair the victim, that happens, and figure out what sort of setting that needs to look like and whether it needs to be supervised or whether there should be no contact at all. So sort of that there's that aspect of an ongoing relationship to deal with while still trying to preserve safety above all. And we know that a significant number of women want to stay in relationships. We know that it takes many, some choose never to leave, some choose to leave and come back, some choose to seek access 7, 8, 9, 10 times to learn about their options. And we have to make sure that, as I said, that we're giving accurate information, but we have to plan, and I think we're just starting at the start of recognizing that reality and to do the safety planning, realizing that some may never leave and some may not leave yet, and to deal with the reality of safety and the perpetrator's relationship then. And then the third point I wanted to mention was in follow-up of Steve's here about, Belshaw, the issue about batterer's intervention program. I think we're just, again, at the very start of recognizing that not all violence is the same in context. Our response in condemnation and safety and accountability needs to be the same. But trying to make sure that when we do intervene, whether it's the courts or otherwise, that we're doing it in a manner that doesn't worsen safety issues and recognizes both the safety of the victim and the children, and also is proportionate isn't the right word, but that addresses appropriately whether this is, you know, a very long pattern or a situation or perhaps undisclosed abuse in the past that we need to find more information about. Research is just getting started. We're 20 years behind substance abuse and sex offender research in really trying to understand more about effective interventions with domestic violence. So these kinds of pilots, these kinds of partnering with researchers and clinicians, these are the kinds of partnerships that we're just really starting to make a go of here in Oregon to be effective about what we do.
Thank you, Judge. Doug, would you come up?
Madam Chair, I think what's missing is my point, is we know abuse is learned and perpetuated, and Lauren's working on the front end with these girls. Somebody needs to be working with boys, too.
Yeah.
And Your Honor.
Hopefully Doug is going to be.
Okay. With all due respect, the piece that really bothered me about what you said was of honoring the, or even considering the perpetrator, we'll put it that way, the abuser's rights with the, to see children. I think they lose that right when they do that. And maybe that's just my opinion, but that's what, where children learn it's okay if they see that. They need to learn it's not okay.
Okay, we're going to hear from Doug right now. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs, and I realize you have to go to the floor very soon, but I was sitting out here. I'm the vice chair of the Washington County Commission on Children and Families, and I also represent in this building the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs, and so these are very important issues. And I will say that the commission structure throughout the state focuses an awful lot of time on abuse prevention. And I wanted to echo something that Sybil said, which is economic conditions drive an increase in this type of behavior. But having said that, there's a generational pass down of this type of behavior. If one generation passes it down to the next generation and the next generation, and there's no effort to interrupt that behavior among a set of parents, then this will continue and increase. And so one of the things our commission has focused on in the past 15 years is trying to interrupt that behavior early on. And so we focus on getting to, especially first-time mothers and fathers, early in the pregnancy or shortly after delivery, with programs like Healthy Start, which try to connect parents with counselors and educators on the right ways to raise your kid. And so if you can break that cycle of violence at that point, you reduce the chance that it's going to be passed on. The problem is that we've seen the commission structure suffer through a 38.7% cut in funding since 2001. The system, and we don't directly fund programs, don't directly do programs, we fund nonprofits and others to do them. So when you have 38.1% or 7% less funding for programs like Healthy Start, programs like our Youth Advisory Commission, programs like Runaway and Homeless Youth or Foster Youth Intervention, those are prevention programs that evidence shows save, 30-40 to 1 over a long period of time. And so it is a funding issue to a certain extent. We need the resources at the local level to be able to help coordinate between law enforcement, education groups, healthcare groups, counselors, et cetera. And that's what the commission structure does at the local level. So there's an awful lot of very good research on what can be effective in stopping the cycle of violence. We don't have a lot of time today to go into it.
We don't.
But I will say that in each one of your districts, there are commissions that work with their partners, and funding for things like Healthy Start are really important in addressing this issue.
Thank you, Doug. And I know, let's see, we had a couple of questions from the few people who were left. We don't have a quorum now. Shall I end the formal part of the meeting, or just continue?
We're in information.
Okay, all right. Suzanne, and then.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Tomei. I just wanted to say that I was impressed with Lauren's presentation, because if you want to know what influences children, work with 3 to 5 year olds, and the next, and they come to school, and you know what television show they had watched the night before, because it affects their behavior, and the kids are getting a little more tough and rough, and it's very distressing. And for me, I think we need to look at what our kids are really watching, because I do think there's a predominance of violence on television, and that's the basic medium in a lot of homes that runs all day long. In the program that I also had, we introduced violence prevention curriculum from Washington, the Children's Home Society in Washington State. We also train the schools. Hood River School District is now using it. So there is a lot of work in my district, especially in Hood River County, on violence prevention. And then in terms of what Representative Boone said, a probation officer in Hood River County who was working with the perpetrators suddenly realized, well, what's being done with the victims? So Hood River started in OK, which is, it's not OK anymore to teach the victims how to stand up to this.
And Representative, I'm going to just stop you because I want to make use of our panel. And I would be happy to hear from you later about these programs. Representative Imbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, my interest is a large area that I think would warrant perhaps a future informational hearing, and that's on the how this subject intersects with special populations, you know, that is immigrant populations. I'm really concerned about the developmentally disabled, you know, how they're affected by domestic violence. And a hearing that would look at the problem and then steps being taken to address the problem with those specific populations would really be useful to me.
And as I said, I am very much interested in, and Mel, I'd like to hear you on this issue in the future, because this is a public safety issue, keeping people safe. And what messages somehow are we giving to children? Somehow children are getting this message, obviously very young, that somehow this kind of violence is acceptable, and it blows me away. So on a sociological level, if someone could help me with that, I would be delighted to have more hearings so that we can get to the area of prevention. Certainly we need to deal with the violence that is happening now and the protection of the families, but I want to get at the root cause of this if we possibly can. With that, I really appreciate you coming. This has been a fascinating presentation, and I hope that we have a chance to follow up on this later. Thank you, committee who stayed and staff. Thank you. With that, I'll close the informational hearing on domestic violence and close the House Committee on Human Services.